Originally, the goal or the design was to create this like independent crypto native stablecoin that didn't touch traditional treasuries. But I think the market has sort of dictated or indicated that it's more interested in a scalable product than it is some potentially more decentralized crypto native product.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join me, Ryan Stubbe, Director of Bitcoin Mining, alongside our team of experts, Jason Ward, the head of FCAT Blockchain and Crypto, Parth Gargava, head of digital asset startups in Fidelity Labs, and Jack Newrider, associate at F Prime Capital. Every week, we roll up our sleeves and delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for your weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are that of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hey guys, good morning. A lot's happened this month, huh? Pretty eventful month on the macro front and, you know, particularly also on the crypto front. I think actually maybe before we jump into the stories that we wanted to cover this week, might be worthwhile maybe kind of recapping for some of our listeners, some of the bigger events over the last month and how we've kind of seen that impact crypto markets. Jack, I know you're our resident macro guy. You wanna maybe just give us a brief summary on kind of the things as you see it?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it. It's been a big noteworthy month on the macro front. September historically has been like, it's a big macro month for whatever reason, timing wise of the year. The summer's over, so all the hedge fund traders come back from their vacations and volumes start to pick up and you start to figure out, you know, potentially what direction the market's moving into the end of the year. Some sort of signal there, I guess. September of 2008 was Lehman Brothers and sort of that eventful timing. And there's been a handful of like historical moments throughout September. Not to say that we had any of those this month, necessarily, luckily, of course. But we did have a number of macro markers, I guess, that were important. And then as a result, you mentioned crypto markets have been moving as well. So the Fed cut 50 basis points on Wednesday, September 18th. That was the middle of the month. As fears are shifting, or I don't know if you call them fears, but you know, worries are shifting from inflation to potentially, you know, economic slowdown and the Fed starting to, you know, cut and ease up on the monetary front. So 50 basis point cut, really, that was already kind of baked in to some degree. It was 25 or 50 was what the market was sort of asking, and got 50. Obviously, the presidential election right around the corner, irrespective of party lines, one of the things I think worth mentioning is I haven't really heard too many commentators or people sort of pressing either side on fiscal deficits as a question. We obviously know like debt to GDP ratios in the United States, effectively all-time highs or near it. 1940s was the only other time where you've seen levels that are, you know, 120% debt to GDP ratios, which means, you know, probably continue to see more of what we've seen, which is fiscal deficits and effectively at the end of the day, monetization of those deficits, which just means more dollars in the system and dollar debasement over the long term. Obviously, nothing guaranteed, but that seems to be the direction that we're trending in. And that would be something that I think many in the crypto space would say is good for a Bitcoin, because, you know, Bitcoin has a constraint supply, a predetermined supply schedule. And if you put more units of fiat into the system over time, you're debasing that currency against all assets, right? And we're seeing stocks rally as a result of, you know, some of these things as well. And obviously crypto also rallying. If we look at the day before the 50 basis point cut from the Fed meeting, Bitcoin was at 58,000. It's up 10% from then to close the month here, 64,000. I think a lot of this stuff is related to potentially shifting macro environment that's, you know, easing or the start of an easing cycle from the Fed. We also had news out of China where China has some sort of fiscal impulse and stimulus. Chinese stocks having their biggest single day rally since 2008, 8.5% in a single day. And then also, again, to that point, presidential election and not really a talk about raising taxes or cutting spending. It's kind of quite the opposite, it seems to be the conversation.
Yeah. And Jack, one other thing with the Chinese banking system, it was reported that they're going to lower their reserve ratio requirements by about 50 basis points as another means of trying to stimulate borrowing and lending to help that market that's seen relatively weak credit demand. But I think one of the things you talk about in terms of the deficit, just a kind of an interesting perspective, is that with the growth of stablecoins and stablecoins becoming as a category, fairly large buyers of U.S. debt to back their stablecoins. This is an interesting place because it seems like they will continue to have an opportunity to access those underlying treasuries, but they may pay a lower rate on a go-forward basis. So we've been seeing that the treasury yields are declining, and looking out at the curve now, you have to go. I don't even know that we even have any treasury bills notes that are above 5% at this point. I think everything's down 4 handle. I think maybe 4.7, 4.8, maybe in the longer end. But that's, I think, to your point, that seems like looking back at past times of monetary easing, it becomes potentially a bullish cycle for Bitcoin.
A really interesting backdrop, right? In the U.S., the election, that will, of course, could have a significant impact on markets in general. But then if you kind of just zoom out, even the geopolitical situation globally is, reaching a little bit of a boil, right? So I think that'll be something to monitor too in the context of the impact on the crypto markets.
Yeah, a lot of people have also speculated that cutting and the reduction of short-term interest rates is potentially positive for DeFi because yields within DeFi become more attractive. And you also just get more speculation during times of risk-on environments if that's what we actually are moving into. You have more liquidity, more volume flowing through these protocols, and therefore higher rates on-chain. And then also higher rates on-chain relative to potentially Fed funds rate that's falling, which means traditional money markets or places where people may keep their cash to earn interest maybe become less attractive on a relative basis, which is sort of the opposite of what we had seen over the prior year or two. And can't forget, right? It's been 6 months or so since the halving. Yeah. That is historically, again, you can be a halving believer or denier. I don't even know what I believe. But historically, Bitcoin has moved in these four-year cycles where you have a reduction in the issuance of Bitcoin that is mined every single block, and therefore you get supply constraints is the theory. But you've seen like 6 to 18 months out from the halving has historically been the best time period for Bitcoin and for broader crypto, obviously, as
right.
a result too. So.
Whether that happens this time around, that's not a prediction, right? I think there's a variety of other variables this cycle, right? Particularly with like the ETP products, right? That had a significant impact on the kind of supply demand balance within the market. But yeah, definitely good call out. So I think with regard to the stories we wanted to cover today, there were two that we wanted to cover, and they're both somewhat of a continuation from our discussion last week around tokenization in general and stable coins. So the first was the story out of Athena launching a new stable coin that's backed by BlackRock's Spittle. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then I think we also wanted to talk a little bit about an announcement coming out of Visa regarding them standing up their own tokenized asset platform. So with that, Jack, you want to talk a little bit, I know you've kind of covered Athena before. You want to just, maybe spend just 2 minutes recapping what their current product is and then maybe just comparing that with this new product that's going to be coming to market?
Yeah, for sure. We've talked about Athena quite a bit in the past, but for those that maybe our new listeners, Athena offers effectively what we'd call a tokenized carry trade, which takes advantage of the fact that there's a lot of people on crypto exchanges that want to speculate, and quite often they want to speculate with a long position. And so on perpetual futures exchanges within crypto markets, think of the largest are Binance, OKX, BitGet, Bybit. You can go on, you can post some form of collateral, typically stablecoins is what a lot of people will use, and then you can make a directional bet on where you think the market is going, and you can do it with leverage. That would be why these people are using these platforms rather than just holding spot. And when there's a lot of people that want to get long at the same time in any particular asset, say Bitcoin, compared to the number of people that want to take a short position, perpetual futures effectively fix themselves to find enough people that want to take the short side by having one side of the trade pay the other. So typically what we see is historically 90% of trading days, longs have paid shorts on these exchanges. And so you can run a market neutral trade by holding the spot asset. If it's Bitcoin, you can hold Bitcoin and then you can sell a short position and have a delta neutral position. And 9 out of every 10 days, historically, you would have gotten paid on the Bitcoin leg and you'd be hedged. Obviously, you have counterparty risk with whatever exchanges you're using, but you have no exposure to the actual price movement of Bitcoin, but you have exposure to the change in funding rates. And so Athena productized that into a product called USDE. They started with Ethereum, so they took liquid staked Ethereum, so STETH most often. You get paid 3% because of the staking rate or whatever the staking rate is at that given time. And then you take a short position on these perpetual futures to the degree that there's enough open interest, and you're getting paid on both sides of that trade. And again, it would be a delta neutral position. Athena launched this the start of the year. They saw, I think at the peak, $3.5 billion in the strategy. Funding rates and the actual payment that you receive for staking USDE fluctuates with whatever the carry trade is paying at that given time. But we saw, during bullish periods of time where there's lots of people that want to get long exposure, Athena benefits, and that rate can be 20%+ annualized. So 20%+ on a delta neutral trade. That's interesting to a lot of people within the crypto market that are comfortable with those risks. We've also seen the opposite effect. When the market turns bearish, a lot of people want to short at once. And the issue that Athena runs into is that that funding rate can go negative. And then effectively you're chipping away at the principal capital that sits in that stablecoin-like asset. Of course, it's not a stablecoin, it's a carry trade. That issue is what Athena is trying to address. And they just announced this past week that they're launching effectively a traditional stablecoin with the backing of Securitize BlackRock's Biddle Fund. So it's similar to what Ondo has done, where they're effectively wrapping Biddle, the BlackRock fund that's on chain, and then helping distribute that via their partnerships and agreements that they've made. They're launching this new token called USTB that will be separate from Athena's USDE, and will sort of leverage Athena's existing relationships. I think they integrated with Bybit and BitGet to use USDE as collateral. This other product can also integrate in some of those relationships and leverage those relationships. The interesting part of this story is, though, the core constraint for USDE has been a capacity constraint of how large the carry trade can get, because there's only, at the time, if you measured it 6 months ago, there was only really like $10 or $20 billion of total open interest across these exchanges at any one given point in time. And Athena could only get to, 30, 40% before rates start to move around and they start to become almost too large. And there's a size constraint to what USDE is doing with the carry trade. What Athena announced is, with the launch of this product, they're also going to post a governance vote to allow Athena to approve the ability for USDE to actively switch between running the carry trade versus holding traditional stablecoins inside of the USDE wrapper. And so what you can do is basically optimize for when the carry trade's attractive on behalf of USDE holders to run the carry trade and earn, you know, a greater than risk-free rate. And then when the carry trade's not attractive, to move out into, you know, the money market fund-like position. And that removes effectively the capacity constraint that you would have on the product. And, you know, I think potentially makes it interesting and more scalable.
So it's really about, you know, augmenting the existing solution so that it could scale further, right? I think that's, and from a distribution perspective, Jack, like you mentioned that, you know, they'd be able to kind of wrap this product and you know, leverage their existing relationships from a distribution perspective. I mean, I'm curious, like, the value proposition on that, right?
Yeah, you know? I mean, to be honest, I'm starting to see a lot of these, like, money market fund yield bearing stablecoins as being relatively commodities. I mean, obviously you're partnering with different people, you're trusting different relationships and different regulatory environments that these things are stood up in. But largely, you know, the ability to access what is effectively risk-free rates on chain is starting to be commoditized. So I don't really think that's the interesting part here. For Athena, I think the interesting part is what they're going to do, it looks like, to USDE, which is previously you had relied upon the free market to basically rationally say, like, oh, the carry trade's not attractive. I need to take my assets out of USDE and put it into a traditional stablecoin until the trade gets attractive again. And that had started to happen. We actually saw $1 billion in redemptions from USDE. It went from $3.5 billion in TVL to $2.5 billion, which is roughly where it currently is. But now you actually wouldn't really need that to happen if this governance vote is approved, because Athena inside of the USDE wrapper will just actively optimize based on whether the carry trade's attractive or if it's not attractive. Originally, the goal or the design was to create this, like, independent crypto native stablecoin that didn't touch traditional treasuries. But I think the market has sort of dictated or indicated that it's more interested in a scalable product than it is some, you know, potentially more decentralized crypto native product. And so it's like a pivot towards what the market's asking for, demanding effect.
Well, and the scalability limitations are very real, right? Particularly in the context of the overall, you know, stablecoin market and how much we've seen these projects grow, right? I think if you're really looking for to scale, right, again, in the context of what that means in a stablecoin product, right, you would absolutely hit that limit pretty quickly.
Yeah, like Athena was already starting to bump up against the limitations of how large the carry trade is and how much capacity they could possibly have. And remember, like, Tether is $120 billion in AUM and Circle is like 30, 35. And they're not even 10% of what Circle is. And they already were starting to see potentially, like, outflows coming in because they're getting too large. Now, what might be interesting here is, like, if they're really successful and assuming that this governance vote gets approved for them to utilize this product inside of USDE, like, USDE continuing to see inflows will just make it become effectively a money market fund, because in theory, if it continues to see inflows, it'll just own more and more of this new product inside of it, and, you know, a little bit of carry trade on the margin. But that would be, you know, kind of the logical conclusion of if it's super successful and continues to scale. But who knows?
Yeah, that's interesting for sure. All right, let's switch gears a little bit. So Jason, do you want to talk a little bit about the announcement out of Visa around their tokenization platform that they're launching?
Yes, we've been talking about Visa, it seems like, a little bit more frequently lately. And, you know, they've been making inroads across the ecosystem. You know, they have a credentialing capability where they allow users to have increased privacy for when they transact with exchanges. And, you know, this other newer announcement is related to tokenization, where Visa is essentially offering a sandbox to banks, it seems, at day one, with Spanish bank BBVA being the earliest user. And what Visa wants to do is provide the tools to allow banks to create basically tokenized fiat on chain. And, you know, from a Visa perspective, they've been integrating with stable coins, and I believe they support USDC on both Ethereum and Solana. Now they're looking at, I think, trying to create a hub and spoke type model where their platform is a hub for banks to issue bank stable coins, bank-backed stable coins for use across transfers between banking clients, potentially cross-border commercial transactions. And this also builds upon Visa's support for different central bank digital currency initiatives, where they've previously been working with, I believe, South Korea and in Brazil in support of their own CBDC exploration. So, it's not South Korea. It's Hong Kong Monetary Authority. It just came back to me. So I think here you have this global player, which coincidentally, they were the sponsors of the stablecoin report that was just produced, co-written by Brevin Howard and folks over at Castle Island.
Which is a really interesting report, definitely worth checking out if you haven't already.
Absolutely. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention also Artemis as a data science layer contributing to that report. But basically, I think Visa looks around the world and says they have 100 or 130 million different places where they're connected, so people can interact. They're in over 200 countries. And for themselves, they've been a key player in the global growth of payments. And this is a way to stay relevant and to stay cutting edge ahead of others who take advantage of their traditional network. They're going to make it easier for them to be able to take advantage of the blockchain. So the sandbox is initially working with select customers or piloting it in a test net. And it looks like in 2025, they want to be able to utilize it on the Ethereum mainnet.
Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, we I think it was just last week or the week prior that we were talking a little bit about MasterCard and what they were doing in this space. Right. And I think these large payment companies are very keenly focused, on the integration of stable coins, as well as bringing their own solutions to market, on the B2B payment side as well. I think this is maybe a little bit different, right, regarding the focus on banks and tokenizing deposits. Right. I mean, this would be it kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong, it feels maybe a little similar to what we saw with JPEM coin. Now that's an internal solution, right? But it's really with the purpose of kind of facilitating payments or movement of assets between, subsidiaries of JPM.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's similar and different. And that biggest difference being that in the JP Morgan case, it's a captive ecosystem. But here, leveraging public blockchains, what they're able to do is provide rails and tools that can be used to facilitate the transfer of value 24/7/365, as long as they are confident that that value is backed. So I think the transparency aspect here around the reserves backing the bank stablecoins, should the banks be issuing stablecoins, is going to be paramount to people's trust.
And you really do have like TradFi incumbents from both sides of this space, paying attention where, on one end, MasterCard and Visa and others that are paying attention to the implication for the payments side of like stable coins and what that could do. On the other side, you have BlackRock, Franklin Templeton, and others in sort of the TradFi investment space that are looking at money market fund yield savings vehicles as a concept and what the implications of blockchain is there. Like, You're seeing it from both sides. So I think you'd say clearly we're onto something here in the crypto.
Well, it's been a definite trend recently. And like what concerns me, concerned maybe isn't the right word, but it seems that everyone is working on their own proprietary solution, which kind of lends itself to the question as to what the interoperability, right, looks like between all of these individual solutions. Because the idea is, the goal, of the technology is to be able to enable kind of open, permissionless access to these systems to an extent, right? And we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about permissioned versus permissionless. But when you create these siloed systems, then the kind of the next problem is okay, how do they communicate with one another to facilitate, in this example, the flow of capital from point A to point B, and how many systems does that have to flow through to do that? And then when all is said and done and you've transitioned to these blockchain-based rails, quote unquote, right? How many, how similar does it look to the existing system and some of the pain points that we have there, right? And we've heard so many people in the industry talk about this problem of recreating what we have today, you know, using blockchain-based systems. And if we really did that, well, maybe we won't be, well, we likely won't be that much better off, right, than we are today.
The argument, there's two sides to that argument here, right? One is this is all new technology, and so it's survival of the fittest and iteration on multiple fronts using different chains and technology and with different ideas, you know, a survival of the fittest effectively approach. But that then leads you into this state of like, well, if there are, assuming there are multiple things that are going to work, then you have this issue of fragmentation. On the other side, it's like, well, what if we could have coordination and unification around one set and standard? But again, to that issue, it's like, well, will it be done on the right technology? And how will we know unless we experiment with all of this stuff? So you are at this weird kind of trade-off and crossroads.
I want to build on what Jack's saying, and I do want to sort of take the devil's advocate role here and say, I don't care that these different banks are going to be issuing different stablecoins as long as the unit is consistent and they can prove they have the reserves for it. Because when you think about it, today we look at this correspondent banking, and banks have accounts and they reconcile accounts with each other. They call it Nostro Vostro. If you can make the transfer of value be essentially a liability against a deposit that's held at a different bank, and you know the bank is fully funded, that you're not operating off of a fractional reserve for that bank, to me, it's like I've got a dollar bill or a different dollar bill, another serial number, but I can move that back and forth. And I may have increased confidence that there is, in fact, value backing that because they could put an attestation on chain, or there may be some other way to verify. Mm-hmm. And when I think about standards, I agree with you. You need to have the standard unit. You need to have standards for how you can prove that they are fully backed. And then when you get to that next layer where you're talking about the interoperability, things that could be cross chain, whether it's moving from a permission chain to a public or one public to another public, that the emerging class of connected orchestration layers is something that will help with that. And it's not to say that I think you're wrong. Not at all. I'm just looking at that and saying, you know, it was roughly, 18 months ago, and we had U.S. banks that were essentially shuttered because they were perceived to maybe be riskier. And people had questions about whether or not their deposits would be insured. And the government stepped in and said, we'll insure all deposits. But I would rather know that I have a value that's a stable coin that I know is fully backed than assume that a regular entity will step in and essentially bend the rules so that my value will not be eroded because it's above the insured depository level.
Yeah. Also, like if you just zoom out and this trend of TradFi utilizing and experimenting with blockchains, it's pretty impressive. Like if you go back 5 years and you ask the question of like, would we be where we are today in terms of it feels like there's far more traditional institutions that are now experimenting and coming around to digital assets and what that implication is for traditional finance than there are that are holdouts that are still sort of denying its existence or potential usefulness.
Yeah, no, there's a definite evolution that's happened there. I mean, the field is much more crowded, which made me think, you know, okay, that now we have, you know, X number of firms that are working on, you know, solutions in parallel. How does that shake out in the long term, right? It's almost like it's similar to the discussion of, you know, that we were having years ago around which chain is going to be the winner, which network's going to be the winner, right? Like kind of feels there's a similarity there. And the answer probably will be there will be more than one, right? Yeah. It's just a matter of what kind of consolidation around these initiatives happens between you know, or I guess over the next couple of years, right? Because there's a general recognition that this is here to stay, and I think that's, you know, represented in how many firms are now sitting at the table, right, and innovating in the space.
Well, I think you're spot on, and we look back. I think many of us felt like this was going to happen. It took a little bit longer, but what changed is that the career risk really was reduced because you no longer had to be on that edge of, you know, this person might go crypto native and can we trust them? Are they really here? Or getting people getting frustrated with the TradFi saying, I need to go crypto native because we're not moving fast enough. But then you also have this evolution of compute power. And you talk about the data center and the fast processing of the chips and the AI. And let's face it, the programmability of the assets on chain can automate a lot of business processes, which means you can be much more effective. And hopefully in time, these investments will have significant ROI, and you can reduce errors and omissions, and you can improve the experience of the user so that we have a financial system that is keeping pace with the growth of technology. And again, yep. Keeping in mind, we look at this through the first world perspective. In some of these emerging markets, and that's the whole point of the piece that Castellan contributed to that Visa sponsored, it's looking at the use of stable coins in emerging markets and the fact that they're not just speculative investments, they're actually everyday utilities. And this is how people are saving, and this is how people are conducting commerce. And that's just one category of the digital asset space.
Yeah. No, this will be a super interesting trend to watch. And I think it's our duty to help digest it for everyone who comes here every week and listens to the podcast. So you know, stick with us on this journey. It's definitely going to be an extended timeline, but certainly one that's going to be really interesting with many twists and turns. All right, I think that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you guys for the discussion, and thanks everyone for joining. And we will talk to you all soon. Have a great rest of your week. See you. Bye-bye.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2024 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 10404056.